Welcome to episode 30 of the Talent Intelligence Collective podcast. I'm your host, Alan Walker, joined as always by my fantastic co-hosts, Alison Ettridge of Stratagens and Toby Coulshaw of Amazon. We have an exciting guest with us today, Martin Hansen from Novartis. Martin is based out of the Netherlands and has become passionate about workforce strategy, workforce management and leveraging global talent. In our news segment, Toby will update us on the latest developments in the talent intelligence space, including the war for AI talent, Latin America's tech talent boom, and the UK's new immigration salary thresholds. Then, Alison will dive into an engaging discussion with Martin about his perspectives on talent intelligence and workforce strategy. Key topics include Martin's career journey, his experience working in India, the concept of total workforce, proprietary workforce drivers, and the impact of his work at various organisations. We uncover Martin's valuable insights on bringing together procurement, HR, and external data to enable better workforce decisions and drive business outcomes. Stay tuned for more wisdom from our workforce geek, Martin. Until then, keep learning and stay intelligent. Before we get on with the main event, I just wanted to remind you that this podcast is proudly sponsored by our friends at Stratagens, and here's a very well-spoken chat to tell you a little bit more about them.
Stratagens gives HR leaders the data they need to transform businesses with the speed and ease required in today's world. If you're ready to make decisions that aren't lengthy, costly, one-dimensional, or based on gut feeling, visit stratagens.com. That's stratagens.com to register for a Wednesday demo drop-in and find out more.
Hello and welcome to episode 30 of the Talent Intelligence Collective podcast.
Yay!
As always, I'm joined by my fantastic co-hosts, Alison Ettridge of Stratagens and Toby Coulshaw of Amazon. And I'm Alan Walker, by the way. Say hello, folks.
Hello, folks.
We have an exciting guest with us today. Please welcome Martin Hansen from Novartis. Martin, it's great to have you on the show. Could you give our listeners a brief introduction about yourself and your role?
Absolutely. Hello, folks, as well. Martin, based out of the Netherlands, born and raised there, and had the pleasure of living in India for a couple of years as well. I've been actually the last 15 years or so become really passionate about workforce strategy, workforce management, and leveraging global talent and the ability to make the right choices for hiring employees, contingent or versus outsourcing, and even robotics and AI today to get your work organized. So yeah, happy to talk much more about that today.
Brilliant. Thank you, Martin. We're thrilled to have you here, of course, and I'm sure our listeners are eager to learn more about you and your insights on talent intelligence and workforce strategy. For those listeners that are new to the podcast, let me quickly run through our usual format. Firstly, Toby will update us on the latest news and developments in the TI and people space. Then our master interviewer extraordinaire, Alison, will dive into an engaging discussion with Martin about his perspectives on TI and workforce analytics and workforce strategy. And then finally, I'll jump back in to wrap things up and bid you all farewell until the next episode. So without further ado, as they say, let's get the show on the road. Toby, over to you.
Thank you very much. Quite a lot going on in the news at the moment, which is always a good thing. Hottest topic really is the war for AI talent. We're always banging on about wars for talent, and I don't particularly like that analogy, but you know, there we are. Elon Musk has been jumping in saying that rivals are stealing his top AI engineers for and he's not happy about that. That's life. But it really is across all of the big tech companies. So Microsoft just announced they're doing a new AI tech hub in London. Meta are getting very busy in the space. It's just a very, very hot space. And the reality is it's rapidly, rapidly grown. And there isn't enough talent in this area. So, we're seeing salaries grow massively. We're seeing location strategy come in heavily. And we're seeing smaller companies feeling the squeeze, really, because they don't have the finance to really push back. Obviously, there's a big amount of VC funding in the space at the moment, so there is some looser purse strings knocking around. But yeah, we're definitely seeing this a really aggressive talent marketplace for this all AI talent at the moment.
I love this one. Just it's kind of like, okay, here we go again. It's just that we've tagged it with AI, isn't it? It's just, you know, the war for talent in any way, shape or form. And with the greatest respect to Mr. Musk, people wouldn't leave if they didn't, yeah, you know, if they really wanted to stay. I think what's interesting over this one is how much the projects that people are working on influences whether or not they take a role versus equity versus salary versus comp versus all of that sort of stuff. Because yeah, we know from experience that actually it's much more about the projects that you're working on and how cool it is and less about how much money you chuck in someone's pocket.
I think certainly at this stage, isn't it, where we're kind of at the beginning of this journey, then people want to get in the cool stuff because they know if they're involved in the cool stuff early on, the money will flow eventually further down the line anyway. I think in a more developed space, more developed market, those other factors become more important because there's less cool stuff to do. But at the moment, there's a ton of things that people can get their teeth stuck into. So it makes sense that they're going to gravitate towards that, doesn't it?
I do wonder if indeed organizations and countries have learned from it, governments have learned from the previous wars on talent and actually accelerate with education early on.
I think they are, but I don't think they can keep up. And that's where I know later we're going to talk about the UK's changing in immigration policy. I think they're doing a typical reaction where they're going to try and buy in talent rather than build. But I think the point around being able to work on interesting stuff is completely valid. One of the articles in Business Insider, Aravind Srivanas, the CEO of Perplexity, was talking about the fact that he couldn't hire AI researchers from Meta because his startup just didn't have enough GPUs. So the in NVIDIA chips that they all wanted to be running on, he didn't have enough. So that the actual power and the engine room essentially behind it meant that the researchers were looking at it going, you're just not attractive enough an option. And I think that's a really interesting piece. And I think, Alan, to your point, they know they're going to get paid well wherever. So it's kind of irrelevant. This is the moment to kind of build the CV and say, can I build something that's genuinely game-changing or world-changing? And I think that's you get fewer of those moments in time.
I think that point about hardware is a really interesting one because in the past, most recent technology innovation has been based primarily around software and coding, et cetera, et cetera. But now hardware has come into the mix with the whole GPU piece. And it's like, I guess, hiring someone and going, hey, we want you to do some amazing, really cool stuff. Here's a calculator. If they haven't got the hardware to back up the kind of software and the research and ultimately the compute power that's needed to do cool stuff in AI, then they're already behind the curve.
There's also an interesting juxtaposition in the fact that it's people that are and their intelligence that are restricting our ability to build artificial intelligence. Yeah. You know, it's just and how it all still comes back to people and talent and specific skills.
But I also wonder whether I completely agree on that. But I also wonder when we had a chat back in the beginning of the year, we were talking about some friction between in one of the fan companies. I think it was Meta off the top of my head, but correct me if I'm wrong. Where you had different internal teams fighting for processing power and access to the hardware, and I wonder whether. Yes, at the moment there's a price point difference and the smaller firms are potentially losing out. But I wonder in the medium run where you go, well, actually, the smaller firms will probably have a much cleaner line of sight of this is our offering. Yes. This is what we do. And if somebody can align with that, great. They're going to get all the resources for it. Whereas at some of the larger firms, it might be these are our offerings and you've got to fight for that computing power amongst 10 different offerings, 20 different offerings internally. So I wonder whether that might actually play in the favour of the smaller firms or medium-sized firms.
It's really interesting.
Yeah. And
sorry, Alison, you go.
I think to Martin's point is that, governments are now busy looking globally, right? And we'll do a lot more about global workforce in our deep dive, but they're busy looking globally for this talent because the education system hasn't caught up. And I almost wonder in this space whether it ever will catch up because everything is moving so fast. You're straight into how do we build the skills rather than how do we build the coding or the tech or the, you know, the hard skills, if that makes sense. It's much more about ability and a broader changing education system to support that globally.
What else is happening then, Toby?
Completely agree. So next up, we kind of touched on it earlier. There's been a big hike in immigration salary thresholds in the UK coming in from April 2024. And it hasn't landed very well generally. I know we spoke about this many, many moons ago when it was first proposed. But yeah, there was a big article in Personnel Today by Adam McCullough. Probably murdering your name there, Adam. Apologies. But really interesting article on businesses will be priced out of the market for talent because of these new immigration rules. It's quite a big jump. It's being increased by 48%, which is huge.
Wow.
From 26K, or just over, to nearly £39,000 a year, which is considerably above the average salary in the UK. So I think it's really is quite a big impact, particularly when you consider kind of the overall workforce shrinking we're seeing and the shrinking workforce, working population pyramid, etc. I don't know. For me, it feels like I assume the government are looking at it going, we only want to bring in, you know, people with high tech, AI, for example, backgrounds, and they're going to be the highest salaries, etc., etc. But I think for me, it's just carving out swathes of our economy and our services industry that's not paid anywhere near enough, that amount, and, you know, arguably not paid enough in most jobs. But that's where we need the vast majority of these workforce. Like, I just think it's a really popularist call and a piece for the general election and et cetera, that rather than actually something to address the workforce. But I could be wrong.
Yeah, it's really interesting, is it? Because actually, most of the roles where you need people physically to be in a location, i.e. here in this country, are the ones that are the lower paid. The higher roles, the higher paid salary roles, those people could be anywhere in the world. Exactly. You can employ them anywhere in the world, mostly. So, yeah, it's a very strange decision in my mind.
Yeah, I'm fully with you on that one. And we see the same in the Netherlands. There's a huge housing shortage, very practical issue, but still we also obviously need a lot of knowledge migrants and people for a labor market. But this is where I indeed think if we would focus on the physical deskless workers to move to the Netherlands and to have to leverage much more remote working opportunities, that would solve a lot of practical issues as well. But
And it's the same in Ireland, right, where there are, again, massive housing shortages. So it's, you know, the problems are suddenly not necessarily the shortage of talent. It's, okay, well, if we can attract the talent, we can pay the talent, where the heck do we put them? And how do we make sure we've got the infrastructure to support them? But I think it's, I don't know, I need to dig deeper into this one, because they're talking about the roles that are going to be, or the industries that they say are going to be most affected. Engineering, hospitality, horse racing, architecture and IT startups. Well, if I take engineering, architecture and IT startups, there aren't many roles in any of those types of industries that already pay less than 38,700. So then you're kind of like, well, okay, but I think they're probably already paying that. It's the hospitality, it's the horse racing, it's the ones where people have got to be, you know, in situ, as you said. Yeah, you can't remotely walk a horse around a ring. Then, you know, those are the ones that are going to be challenged, I think. And so we're back to that kind of lower paid workforce again. Maybe they're trying to encourage other people into work. I don't know.
Maybe. I did smile at the summary of the article when horse racing was one of the things there, and I wasn't quite sure whether horse racing was a massive bedrock of the UK economy.
Oh, it is. It's enormous.
Really?
Yeah. I'm going to have to dig out the details now. Just ignore me. Yeah, I mean, you'd be surprised, but it is. It's right, really enormous, particularly by the time you allow for things like the betting industry.
If you go to that, because, if you expand it out to that, absolutely, I guess, yeah.
The bit that I thought was interesting about the numbers is the higher rate for tax in the UK. So when you shift from the basic tax rate of 20% to the higher rate of 40%, is £37,701. So it just feels a bit too coincidental that they've just snuck it in just over the higher rate tax rate for my liking. It's feels a bit cynical.
4 billion a year.
There we go.
What's that? The horse racing is worth. Yeah. Right.
It employs 88,000 people, so it's not huge, but it's a fairly big chunk.
I bet it pales into insignificance compared to hospitality, though, doesn't it? And I'd throw, surely retail potentially should be in there, and healthcare as well, because they're all, maybe not retail as much, but healthcare's reliant hugely on an immigrant population, or it typically has been.
Yeah, don't know.
Yeah, hugely.
Okay, what else is happening, Toby?
A couple of other bits. LATAM. We don't often talk enough about LATAM, so I'm quite excited about LATAM today. Really looking at LATAM and its tech talent boom. So with a lot of companies, obviously there's been very highly publicised layoffs, etc., but also people looking to right size and shore in the right locations. For example, LATAM is seeing a really big push, and they've had a lot of government investment, and they've done a lot of work producing more digital talent, and it's really coming through. So Mexico and Brazil alone are churning out over 600,000 software engineers and developers. So it's a very busy space. So yeah, I think it's really exciting. I think obviously time zone wise, LATAM, you're hitting that core US market. You've got the skill sets, you've got the language capabilities, you've got to, I think it's really exciting. And some of the real infrastructure stuff that used to cause problems, that's the stuff that the government's also been really investing into, is to make sure that you've got that infrastructure in place, internet access, et cetera, to make sure you've got the sustainability of the investment. So I think that's really, really interesting times. I think, you know, we've had so much friction in the US talent landscape because we've had so much of tech talent just distilled into a very few hubs. And yes, we saw that, you know, disperse out a little bit through the COVID times of people going remote, but it's really still finding a little bit of friction there, I think. Whereas I think this whole LATAM option is really going to shake things up.
I think what's really interesting in this space is that, you know, and I'm going to come out of LATAM, I'm going to broaden more widely, but if you look at Mexico, Brazil and Egypt, those are three countries that have done massive investment in their education in order to produce the supply of talent. So they've been thinking, to Martin's point earlier, they've been thinking much more broadly and longer term about access to talent and how that then can drive their economy. I think that's probably the bigger point here, is that, you know, somebody 5 years ago decided that this needed doing, and we're now seeing those results. So it's the same, they're producing, you know, multilingual workforce, time zone that's relevant for a particular region. So in LATAM's case, it's, you know, relevant for North America. In Egypt's case, it's relevant for the rest of Europe. Yeah, I just think it's really fascinating, the different approach that at a broad level governments are taking.
And can I say, I have a personal vested interest in this, as we, Udda, are expanding our horizons. We hired somebody from Buenos Aires back in January who was previously working for one of the major, major HR tech players. And we're not. We're a tiny little player. And we were able to hire her, pay her probably 10%, nearly 20% above market rate there, and still be incredibly good value for money. She is fantastic. Shout out Barbara if you're listening. She's able to service the US market because of obviously location in LATAM, but also she's only 3 hours behind the Europe, so she can kind of cross over into both regions. And she and the team down there that we're slowly building out, just incredibly talented. They've done some really good work in certainly in Argentina, which is a bit, I know, but the wider LATAM space. It's a massive talent pool of incredibly hardworking, brilliant people. So, yeah, they're well done to all of the LATAM countries for putting some time and effort into that, I think.
Yeah, great shout.
Similar to also Africa, I hope on the long run this also helps with migration issues and the more beneficial it is to be able to work from your own country. Again, going back to the remote topic, the more these countries also develop, other countries are able to invest. So I think it on the long run provides a lot more balance.
What I think will be really interesting is whether or not we start to see what we've seen in more developed, forgive me for the generalization countries is that suddenly it's how do we start to attract diasporic talent back to country? So mm-hmm. the talent that has left and gone to different parts of the world, how can we attract that back into country, which is what we've seen in more developed areas, and whether and how long that cycle takes, and whether, you know, maybe it's something for us to look at as strategists and start to see whether or not you can see, you know, and start to predict how long that cycle takes before talent migrates back to region.
And obviously, you saw this with H-1Bs with when the layoffs started hitting the US and people were flying back to India, and then yeah. Canada stepped in and said, "Hold up, if you don't want to go back to India, anyone with an H-1B can come straight in and, yes. and work for us." And I wonder whether that's as you start seeing those migration flows heading back, whether other countries step in and say, "Well, actually, look, come here for a different option once again."
Yeah, love that.
I guess it's almost like a kind of Venn diagram, isn't it? Most people want to live in their own country. Could be close to their family, their friends, etc. But then the big determining factor is if you can go to another country and earn five times, 10 times the money you can earn locally, it's difficult to then make that decision to stay where you are. But as those numbers get closer and closer, there'll be a tipping point. You don't necessarily need to earn exactly what you can in the US to go back to India. But if you can earn half of it, you might go, well, that's more than enough. I can live and be very well off, wealthy, happy, healthy, around my family, etc. And the difference then becomes negligible. There probably is a kind of tipping point, I imagine.
And interestingly, we're starting to see, and this is a bit of a kind of sweeping statement because we're actually doing a project to look into it in more detail, but we're starting to see countries peg salaries to US dollars in order to try to counteract that so that individuals will come back to country. So, yeah, I think there's... I just think that, you know, we've kind of created this global world and each individual country is now trying desperately just to be a country in the war for talent. And it's going, we can't, because talent is, you know, very genuinely now global, which will lead really nicely into the conversation that we have. But I think we should do the bit about AI and recruitment guidance before we do that.
Yes, I definitely want to do that. But I think that last point I just want to pick up on, because I think it's really important, is around that relationship between employer and employee. And I wrote an article about this a little while back, saying around it's like a symbiote and a symbiotic relationship, like you get in nature. But the problem is that's been broken with the layoffs and with the return to office and with the kind of breaking of trust over the last 24 months. I think we're going to see a new relationship where talent is more mercenary than ever. And they don't have that long-term relationship with an employer because they know there's no long-term security there. Because of that, it calls into question everything. So any kind of like long-term incentive schemes you may have that's like rolled out for, you know, 4 or 5 years, I don't think talent's going to be interested. They're interested about the cash today because of the cost of living crisis and very short-term reward because they just don't trust companies for longer term anymore. And I think that will play into the whole kind of fluidity of the talent base as well.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I think that's absolutely something which I've been trying to leverage as much as possible, the flexibilization for companies and leveraging people on their own terms and conditions. But the other element which I definitely wanted to mention here as well is also over time, the culture blend. And to your point, the global talent pool that we're creating, it's fascinating to see how Indians who have lived in the US and studied there for 15 years and they go back, how that over time creates a more blended understanding of each other's cultures. So over time, you see really much better relationships also between companies across different regions because of that cross-pollination. I really like that.
But also, I think in many ways, all of this plays into startup scale-up small businesses, because right from the outset, they've had to be more flexible because they're competing with the big organisations. So I think it's going to impact on the big corporates more than it will impact on the smaller businesses.
Should we do one more news article then, Toby?
Yeah,
last one for the day. So the UK government, UK Department for Science, Innovation and Technology, have launched a responsible AI and recruitment guide, whichever.
Both.
One of the same. Anyway, Do you know what? I was surprised at how interesting it was, if I'm going to be honest. went into the full breadth of the recruitment process, really looking at everything from kind of the tech, the scalability, right through to the risks. And I think there's that risk element that really came through for me, as you'd expect from the government. But I think it's very valid. I think at the moment, the TA industry is getting excited by all the shiny new toys. And we've always had a bit of a magpie effect where it's like, oh, shiny, let's go and play with that. And Alan, I know you're going to be much better versed in this and have a strong opinion than me, but I was pleased to see that the government were flagging up just what the risk exposure on this stuff is and every facet of the installing any kind of AI capabilities. It has an element of bias. Like, depending on what you're training it on, it's going to be biased. It's going to magnify whatever you've had in that training data. So I really, for me, it came through that this stuff isn't as simple as it appears on the cover, and it's not just plug in and play necessarily. And you really do need to make sure you're getting true experts like the wonderful Alan and Udda to come in and do this stuff, because it's really hard and it's high risk. Like, if you mess this up, you'll get sued, and it's going to cost you a fortune. So yes, there's efficiency gains, yes, there's productivity gains, yes, there's, you know, some great wonderful stuff you can do with it. But it's not the risk-free environment that I think a lot of people think it's going to be.
No, I agree. I'm slightly caveating all of that. Three of the organisations that contributed to the report have a vested interest to a certain degree in maintaining the human input in the status quo. Yes. So APSCO, REC, and CIPD.
Absolutely.
Are massive lobbying bodies for their industries. So I think I'd always... My concern about all of this, and every time I see this kind of thing, is the biggest assessment for any piece of AI technology in a recruitment process or any other process, wherever it might be, is it more biased than the current approach? So start point, end point. Almost to a certain degree, the bit in the middle matters, obviously, and that's the bit you'll get sued for if it's done wrong. But if the starting point of who comes into the process and the end point who comes out of it, are those results better or at least as good as humans?
Yeah. Yeah.
Often we get bogged down by the bit in the middle rather than focusing on that bit. And the bit in the middle is the bit that APSCO, REC and CIPD are really interested in humans being involved in still, because their membership body are humans.
I think you're so right, Alan, because what they're not doing is saying, well, hold on a minute, humans have a bias too. A human makes a decision within 7 seconds as to whether or not it's going to be right or wrong. You know, it's kind of like, well, hold on a minute, you're not comparing apples with apples, because humans are so biased.
Mm.
It's almost you've got this advantage to be less biased than your humans in this process.
Human bias is way harder to actually write down and understand and decipher, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you have 10 humans involved in a recruitment process and all their biases are different.
Absolutely, and harder to change. You know, yeah. All of those sorts of things. So, yeah, I think we could do a whole... Actually, we should do a whole podcast on that. Let's get someone from the REC and APSCO over and let's have it out.
Let's have a debate. Let's get someone from the REC in and let's get somebody that really is full on straight into, like, let's automate, like Stan, for example, and let's have a full on debate about it.
Yeah,
that would be really interesting. Ooh, really two cool guests. Have we ever had two guests?
No.
I think we have.
Yeah, maybe we should do that again.
But yeah, we should. Anyway, talking of interesting, I think it's time to chat more with our guest.
100%.
What do you reckon? Yeah. We've heard Martin's view on the wider world, so let's hear more about his actual work, his work that he's doing on a day-to-day basis. Alison, why don't you take over from here?
Thank you. Martin, we had a lovely conversation in Amsterdam at the Talent Intelligence Conference last year. It was the first time I had the pleasure of meeting you, and I was just blown away by some of the stuff that you've been doing. So I know you've given a quick introduction, but can you do a quick kind of career intro, because your background is kind of military, then IT services, then I think kind of procurement, then workforce, which is pretty broad. So can you just give us a quick background, and then we'll see how that's influenced where you are today.
Absolutely. And thanks for having me. So indeed, I the only thing I wanted to do when I was in high school is become a police officer or get into the military. And So that was my main focus. So I joined the Dutch Army, the engineers, at first for 3 years. And I think still to date, it's been the best start of my career, because that's where you really get to work in a team. You are working in difficult circumstances. It's adventurous, but it's also, emotional, or it has everything that you, it makes you grow up quite quickly, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So that was an absolute great start of my career. But then I also, thought about being away for half a year every year, starting a family. That made me think of maybe it's worthwhile actually getting back into an education and starting a business career. So I done an HR bachelor, organizational development, and started working for a telco company, and spent, I think, in the end around 15 years or so in telco IT engineering companies, mostly on the business side, or organizing my own work with employees, with team members, but also with third parties. At some point, I was responsible with two teams from Amsterdam and the southern part of the Netherlands, where we worked remotely to manage global clients' networks, and all remote. And we were not able to find our own talent for the expansion of our teams. Mm-hmm. So that's was around 2010, where I started looking at the broader the labor market beyond the Netherlands. So the company I worked for at the time was looking into cost reductions, labor arbitrage, and where we were starting to identify what work could be done remotely or could be done overseas. I also started thinking about what would then the best setup be. And it's interesting looking back at it now, my team members were so opposed to it in a way. It was a very hard sell to say we are going to expand the team in India, or we are actually going to move work packages to India. So the outcome of it was like a consensus. That's a typical Dutch way of working. And we said, okay, you know what? We actually built out the team. So we hire people like we hire you, but then we just have a third and maybe a fourth location, which we open, which happens to be not in the Netherlands, but in India. And that looking back, that has been actually a fascinating learning, because instead of lifting and shifting and throwing activities over the fence and not having like your teammates who wears the same shirt, we now actually had people who we brought over to the Netherlands. They saw snow for the first time. I mean, it was you create a team, you're bonding, and then when they returned back, the team worked literally as teammates and talked about their families. We ensured there was a lot of travel back and forth, and that was for me in a very small setting proof on how it could work to set up a remote and distributed a team across quite different cultures. So
what I love about what you've talked about there was that you started to see access to workforce as a restrictor to business growth. Is that right?
Yeah.
And was that, do you think that was because of the sector that you were in, because of the country that you were in, or was it just kind of this broader understanding of the wider world that had come to you because of, possibly because of your military background, right?
Yeah, but it was absolutely not a very conscious decision. It was very much about, okay, we have pain. How do we solve it on the short term? And it happened to be that the company was already looking into outsourcing, and we thought about, okay, how can we leverage that for our team? But the way of setting it up, because one and a half years later, I moved with my family to India to actually ramp up the outsourcing and offshoring drastically. So we set up two delivery centers in Chennai and in Bangalore with almost 1,000 people. So, but we did that in more of a managed services setting and not like an expansion of the team or building a captive entity of that telco at the time. So that's where I also start seeing the difference between one setup versus the other. So I think consciously choosing how you interact with each other, and if you work on outcome basis or services basis, or if you actually expand your team and build up your own capability, I think that is, has been coincidentally, I think the start of me becoming more of a workforce geek and really becoming passionate about the topic.
Okay, so I'm going to dive into the workforce geek bit in a minute, but actually and you've taken the words from my next question kind of out of my mouth in some ways, but how did your time in India really fuel your passion for leveraging global talent, not necessarily Indian talent, but global talent and then talent in any form?
And I think in a couple of ways. One is I always try to enjoy what I do every day, and I absolutely enjoyed seeing from a distance how my very reluctant colleagues in the Netherlands were slowly opening up and finding it very interesting and rewarding addition to what they have been doing for 35 years or how they have been working for 35 years. Because now, instead of feeding one family with one salary, they saw that that 25 people were fed by one salary. So despite the fact that people lost their jobs in the Netherlands, which has quite a good social security network, we increased the lives of a lot of people on the other side of the world. So that's one piece. The other piece is as well, you can look at lifting and shifting activities, doing the same thing, but then in a different place or by a different person. But you can also then start looking at optimizing, leveraging technology, robotics, automation. From there, focusing on efficiency, which I have to say at the same time, is a typical Western thing, to be very generic, I guess, focus on efficiency. Because if you look at India and an Indian airport, then they try to give as many people a job as possible because they just want to make sure that they do the right thing for that large population. Interesting. And by the way, from a family and private perspective, it has been, I think, the best experience I could have given my kids. They did not realize it till they were a bit older. But yeah, I mean, they have seen different things than if they would have stayed in the Netherlands. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, completely. A global view is so important for anyone right in today's world, isn't it? You talk about total workforce strategy as a phrase. Can you talk about what's different about the total when you're talking about it? And what are the key elements that made you think more broadly about workforce?
Yes, I think the word total is not resonating that well anymore. At least that's my view. Total talent management, total workforce management. People have not, and companies have not been really able to grasp the concept, let alone operationalize the concept. So I'm shifting more towards workforce ecosystems or different terminology. But it in the
is
end,
the same thing, just called something different.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah. And but in the end, what it boils down to is pretty much a 9-grid, which shows on your horizontal axis, you have employees, you have contingent worker freelancers, and you have outsourced or automated contract types. Mm-hmm. And on your vertical axis, you can look at your location axis. So high cost, medium cost, low cost, or whatever you want to call it. And if you picture any workforce, you can plot that composition in that, in those boxes. Where is the work done? By how many people, at what cost, and then with what skills? And that gives the visibility. The moment you have that visibility, then that triggers questions. It triggers questions about why are we actually working with an independent contractor who does core work for us for already over 7 years? It might be a compliance risk, thinking IR 35. It might be a knowledge retention risk, plus there's a cost element to it. So total talent for me means something which startups are doing indeed automatically, making conscious choices, first time right for the right contract type in combination with the location. But the larger the company becomes, and I joke sometimes, the moment you hire your first HR officer or procurement manager, then you really start to, you need to be careful, because then your silos start to appear, and then it becomes much more difficult to work across the functions and the silos to consciously, continuously have that deliberate workforce strategy set up.
What I love about what you've just said is I'm just imagining how many people have now got little arrows drawn on a piece of paper in front of them with location on the y-axis and then with work on the x-axis, and going, oh my God, what do we do? When you've got that, when you've got that, well, no, actually, there's a question before that. You talk about that in a way that makes it sound really easy to get hold of that data. And I can hear people screaming at me and going, hold on a minute, how the hell do we know how many contractors we've got and what they're doing and where they work?
I hear them as well. Yeah.
Okay. So where do you start? Where do you start with that internal stuff?
I think it's hard work. I mean, it might sound simple, and that's also probably the difficult part of it, because you need to have someone in the organization who sees this and who actually wants to drive this. And then it indeed starts with visibility. So it's literally pulling open every drawer, digging out what data can we find where. And then the second challenge is bringing it together so that it makes sense. And yeah. It's because of timely payment of salaries. Most of the companies have their payroll under control, and the number of people that work for them, and what type of contracts they're on, fixed term or indefinite or whatever. But the moment you look at your external workforce, then it becomes a lot more difficult if you do not have a similar system supporting it, or a provider helping you with your external workforce management. So I think looking at identifying what data sources is workforce related data, and what do we have, and then doing a gap analysis is where it all starts.
And that's where it's interesting, because of your kind of procurement and HR together view, isn't it? Because actually, if someone had purely come through a workforce or an HR route, they may not necessarily be thinking about invoices generated by contractors, right? But they might think about payroll. So it's the combination of those two. So when you've then got that, so you've then got this kind of, you've pulled open the drawer, you've got this data, you've kind of got it into some format that makes sense, and you've plotted it on this chart, who do you take that to?
Opportunistic as I am, I've always taken it to, currently at Novartis, before at Philips, we've taken it to people who had the most pain or who wanted to hear. It could be as simple as a CFO, if they do not know that you have a huge amount of freelancers working in your headquarters environment, where there's a lot of labor legislative risk, where there's a lot of costs associated to it, not talking even about knowledge retention, but just bringing that cost picture, that triggers questions. So I've always at least tried to avoid drawing conclusions, but just showing the data, and that typically did oftentimes the trick, because then you trigger one question, and the more fleshy things you show, the more fleshy things people want. And to be honest, the first drafts have always been Excel files. So there was not much fluffiness about it. But if you're able to blow up the numbers, because that is what you pay as a company, then people start to wake up in a way, because again, they know the salary cost in the annual reports of major multinationals. You see mostly wage bill and the number of and the personnel, and then maybe 1-3% of temporary staff. But in my opinion, I think 30-40% of companies are comprising of external contributors. Maybe the facility management, IT management, outsourced services, and you could argue, do we care about that piece of our workforce? But I would argue you should, and for a couple of reasons, and that answers gives a second answer to your question on who do you take this to. It's about who has access to your systems or locations. Procurement doesn't. They look at spend and supplier management. HR typically looks at employee management, development, attraction. But who is looking at the risk of not properly offboarding someone who's vacuum cleaning every week but still has a badge and can walk into your offices whenever they want? So let alone having an Active Directory account. Or I'm always getting a bit carried away, Alison, so just let me off when you want.
You're not carried away. Oh, I've gone off funny. Far from it. I think that it's, for me, one of my next questions was, okay, if we're thinking about talent ecosystem, if we're thinking about the talent marketplace as a whole, is this about reducing risk? Is it about reducing cost? Is it about solving talent scarcity, or does it depend?
I think it's all of the above. It's indeed cost, risk, and talent, and it's pretty much that simple. The question is, depending on the biggest challenge or the maturity level or the phase of where an organization is in, what is the button to push? What is the angle to take? And in a highly regulated company, the risk piece is much more easy to sell and to get a business case sold internally. But in other companies, I've experienced that cost was the easiest factor, and cost is always, it always boiled down to cost. I mean, the effect of risk is also a cost effect. But which button to push by whom? That is a bit dependent on the nature of the business, for instance.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course you can.
I got two things in my head. One is related to that 9-box grid from earlier. And apologies, I tried to ask a question, but I was on mute and I couldn't unmute the mic. Technical differences, difficulties.
I'm such a millennial, Toby.
I needed some chatbot just to do it for me. So first one about the 9-box grid type piece. Like I've often thought that what we're seeing with AI and automation is really very similar in some ways to what we were looking at for offshoring and versus nearshoring. And it's looking at the type of the role. So it's how close to a customer is it? Is it standardized and repeatable, et cetera? And it feels like that's a very similar 9-box grid to automation and Gen AI type capabilities. There's things like customer service. That's one question. And the second question...
Well, hold on, you can't just ask a question and then answer it yourself.
I'm not answering. I was going to throw both questions at Martin at the same time.
But okay.
Because I know it's hard for me to get off mute. So that's the first question. And the second question, the risk piece. I was talking to somebody yesterday, in actual fact, about TI and it being a risk mitigation. But quite often companies, I think, don't really care about the risk until something goes horribly wrong. How do you see that? Because obviously you're doing this much, much deeper and at a much more strategic level than most. Do you think that's the case? Am I being too flippant with that? Do leaders look at this and go, actually, yeah, there is a real risk exposure. We need to do something about this actively, or is it more of a reactive thing?
So you need to split those questions. So let's do the 9-box grid one first.
But they're both out there now.
they are both out there now, both taken. So let's do the nine box grid one. Is this similar to looking at automation and the way that we used to, sorry, is the automation grid, the way that we used to look at nearshore, offshore outsourcing?
Yeah, I'm not too sure if I fully understand the question, but for me that triggers the build by borrow framework, so to say, right? So it's about what do you do yourself but that's more the contract type angle, and more companies I see doing that, and you could add another thing on the axis, which is indeed automation and robotics, because if you automate something, you don't need to build or buy. So the bot is being added to the B's a lot. But the base one, the other B that I typically like to add, the location, that is often forgotten in the mix. And that is such a powerful one to look at. If you have talent scarcity in pockets or in areas, then you, one of the last levers that you have, but also one of the most powerful ones, is to look across the borders, right? And I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, Toby, but
yes, all wonderful, wonderful.
So then let's talk about risk then, and I'm really interested in Martin's views on this, because I've got a view too, but I'm not the expert, so let's hear his first.
Well, I'm not sure if I'm an expert, but I have at least had some flying hours, so to say, trying to and I failed so much about positioning certain things, which absolutely did not resonate. Gradually you start mastering a bit more at the sales pitch, but indeed it's about facts and data in the end for me. So risk is about likelihood multiplied by the effect. I think it is, right? That's so how likely is it that it occurs, and what is then the impact of it? And I think Nike recently got fined, or a potential fine, for misclassifying, I think, external workers, $530 million for doing that in four countries. You could argue, well, it might happen only once in 20 years, but then still, I mean, it causes a lot of reputational risk. And if you don't know it as an organization and as a chief risk officer or compliance officer, if you're not aware of the potential risks around this, then it's very difficult to mitigate it. So I think that's where this world of total workforce, integrated workforce, how we call it at Novartis, is really about providing the visibility on, okay, do we at least know what we know? And if yes, then you can say consciously, okay, I'm not going to mitigate it. But if you are not even aware of it, then a simple question that anybody can ask themselves is, do I know how many people have access to my locations or my systems or applications today? Do I know where people sit, what they provide in terms of skills or capabilities into my organization? And the moment you cannot answer the fact that am I 100% secure that people who have left do not have access anymore to my systems, yeah, that's worthwhile looking into it and asking a few questions, right?
Yeah, agreed. And I think what was interesting about the Nike piece, and I'm drawing back from my memory, but I know there was a bit about temporary office workers, but actually it was much more about the external consultants, the photographers, the T-shirt printers, the event planners that were really contractors, right? So they wouldn't have been seen as part of a workforce typically through HR lens. And that for me ties into I have absolutely no flying hours in this area at all, so I'm much more likely to crash into the mountain. But for me, the risk conversation is, it depends entirely on who you're talking to. Because if you're talking to senior leaders in the business, then risk is just up there as their number one. Right? It's how do we mitigate against risk under all circumstances. Toby, yeah. I was expecting you to say something then, and then you just went quiet.
It was very well answered. I like this. Yeah. I like this. I think that probably comes back to, if I'm thinking about the TI lens, purely selfishly, because, you know, I'm a completely selfish narcissist, obviously. It just means we've got to really articulate our end customer. Because if the business really are focused on risk and risk mitigation, then TI is going to be absolutely vital for them.
Completely.
Really nailing that piece down is going to be key.
Yeah, 100%. Completely agree. It should be part of the story and not how do we hire faster, better, smarter. It's, you know, how do we reduce our risk? Marathon, you talk about proprietary workforce drivers. Talk to me about what those are in your view.
Yeah. And well pronounced, by the way, the name.
I've been practicing. Like sometimes I get it right, sometimes I get it wrong.
Yeah, that box ticked. No.
Once.
The workforce drivers is similar to the 9-grid. Is actually something that, again, just by coincidence, but at some point a model falls into place. And I think the combination of the 9-grid as a baseline, and then having your applying your workforce drivers, which I'll explain in a second, to it, that helps them to make conscious decisions for in which of the 9 boxes do you organize organize your work. So I'm giving an example. A workforce driver is how long does the work need to be done? Because that is a driving factor for the sourcing axis. If you need someone for 3 months, it's not so likely that you start recruiting an employee. Maybe fixed term or a volunteer, or maybe an internal job rotation. But typically 90% of managers would go hire a temp worker or a freelancer. But if you have a need, or if the work needs to be done for more than 2 years, then it's more likely that you attract an employee for that, or build up the own capability, or even outsource. So this is how that works. Similar to another simple one is, can the work be done remotely? I don't think I need to explain that one on the vertical axis. But then another one could be, can you describe the work? Can it be outcome based, or can you describe the outcome easily, which then would imply that it becomes more easy to automate or to outsource potentially. And I think the combination of those 5, 6, 7 key questions, fundamental questions, that those for me are the drivers which help you to understand your work requirements better, and then to translate that to the best supply or talent strategy. And I think I can't make it any simpler. We created a simple model on workforcedrivers.com. You can log in with your LinkedIn ID, and it's almost too simple, but that's what it does. And if you're able to then operationalize that in your organization, it gives your managers one entry point into, hey, I have a piece of work which needs to get done. And it's an education tool. It gives them all more options than they have today based on gut feel. It guides and advises them a bit more. I think this is the easiest way to implement a more broader, let's say, total talent strategy.
If you're someone in talent intelligence, so where predominantly you're looking at the external workforce and external data, and you're listening to this and you're just starting and thinking, oh my God, this makes perfect sense, what would you say would be the top 3 tips that you would give that individual? And that might be, who do they talk to? It might be data sets to look at. Or it might just be a starting point. What would be the top 3 things that you would tell them to do?
Well, this is why I asked Toby, do I need to prepare for any trick questions? But no.
Okay, well, my fault. I'll do your top 1, and then it doesn't have to be your top 1. It just buys you a bit of time to think about what your top 3 are. So I'm just going to repeat back while Martin is thinking. I'm just going to repeat back workforcedrivers.com. If you can go on there and log in with your LinkedIn ID, then you will be able to see some of the proprietary workforce drivers. There you are. So has that bought you a bit more time?
Yeah. No, I was just joking, of course. But the I think it starts with what data do we have? What are we leveraging, utilizing? And it's fantastic to have external benchmark data, talent, labor market insights. But hopefully this concept of workforce drivers and total workforce also triggers other insights and intelligence, which can be combined with the labor market insights, which then makes the one entry point and the advisory that you can provide to the business much more valuable and powerful. For instance, if we are now trying to compare what do we pay for an employee role in a certain level in a certain country, and we know that based on our average salary tables and our job taxonomy. So that's a data that we have. If you then would be able to say, well, if you hire this same equivalent skill, but then on a freelance or on a temporary basis in the same market, then this would be the potential cost. And if you do the same for other work types, that gives already in the decision tree, gives the business at their fingertips the decision or the choices on and the recommendations actually from a cost perspective. You can do the same with time to fill. The time to fill for a temp worker is 20, 23 days average versus 60 plus days for hiring an employee. So that with that and with talent intelligence, you can absolutely power your guidance and advice to your business and make a massive impact.
Really interesting. And I think for me, we talk a lot about talent intelligence gives external context to your people plans, right? So you can get the data, but without the context, it may not be relevant. So you've got to have the external context in order to make it relevant. And my final question, if I may, we haven't really talked about anything that you've done at Novartis, but I think If you had to describe the biggest impact that your work has had in any of the organizations that you have worked in, what do you think it would be?
I think it's providing the workforce insights, the visibility, which triggered improvement. So it triggered procurement teams to maybe change their category strategy, their spend management approach, supplier rationalization. It then on the HR side, it triggered workforce transformations, workforce strategies, workforce policies. How do we actually treat externals? Do we know if we treat and pay them fair? Do we indeed make leverage our external contributors, or do we keep focusing on fishing in the same pond for hiring employees in a particular area? So, and then I think the financial one is the most obvious one, which I always keep at last because I don't think that's the best rationale to start this. But if you look at reducing your total workforce cost index, that's something I invented myself, which is reducing your workforce cost, but not just your wage bill, but your total workforce cost against your sales. If that ratio goes down, then you essentially become a lot more productive. But it also means if you're able to show that number, it means that you have the visibility on what your external workforce comprises of, which then also means that you are able to consciously say what we've outsourced 10 years ago, we actually should insource now or create a different setup for that. And at the moment, the visibility is done in silos, and it provides suboptimal improvement opportunities. So I think that would be my the fastest answer I could give, Alison.
I have loved talking to you, and I knew I would. I've scribbled pages and pages and pages of notes which I really wish I'd done when we last spoke. So thank you very much. And I think what's fascinating for me in all of this is that your background, particularly kind of through the procurement and the sourcing piece, made you just look at it in a completely different way to the way that anybody whose background is solely in HR or solely in talent would have looked at it. And it's the way that you've brought those things together. So in summary, you can reduce your risk, you can look at your procurement and your spend, and you can trigger total workforce transformation by just understanding who you've got and where you've got them and what you do with them. I love it. Absolutely love it. Thank you so much. I've also had this other thought, Toby. I've got no idea if you're on mute or not on mute, because I can't. The thing's not working.
Oh, I'm here.
I've had this other thought, which is we should have Martin and Matt Higgs on together. That was my other thought. Yeah, there you go.
I enjoyed that so much that I forgot I was one of the hosts. And just sat here listening.
My world.
Yeah, I just sat here listening like I was listening to a podcast. I was like, this is really interesting. And I'm like, oh, bugger, I'm supposed to jump in at some point and actually kind of wrap things up and bring the show to an end. So I'm going to do that now. Now I've actually got that opportunity and I've back in the zone. So, Martin, thank you for that. That was amazing. It's been great having you on the podcast. How was it for you?
No, I was just thinking you weren't able to find the unmute button, probably. Yeah.
it was just that good.
Yeah, no, and I always like talking about this, and hopefully it makes sense. At least it does to me. But I'm, like I said, became a workforce geek, and I don't think that will change anytime soon.
Excellent. Great. And it's been great having you on the show, and hopefully we can have you on again in the future, as the guys say. So thank you, everyone. Thank you, Toby. Thank you, Alison.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, as always, thanks for you guys for supporting us and telling your friends about us and all that jazz. And as we say here, stay intelligent, folks. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening. Before you go, I wanted for the last time to remind you about our generous sponsor, Stratagens. Here's that posh chap again, telling you about their fabulous product.
Stratagens gives HR leaders the data they need to transform businesses with the speed and ease required in today's world. If you're ready to make decisions that aren't lengthy, costly, one-dimensional, or based on gut feeling, visit stratagens.com. That's stratagens.com to register for a Wednesday demo drop-in and find out more.